clears things out. Our third case for this morning is Mendez against Republic Bank, 12-25-85. Ms. Carsleeper.
May it please the Court, Heidi Carsleeper on behalf of the appellant, Nereida Mendez. We are requesting that this Court reverse the judgment of the District Court and remand the case with instructions to enter the Court's original judgment in favor of plaintiff.
So before you get too deeply into this argument, I would like to know whether there's actually anything still left of this case. Because in the appendix to your opponent's brief, the red brief, there is a document called a release satisfaction of judgment, which indicates that under the auspices of the bankruptcy court, it says, Mendez, the judgment creditor, having received full satisfaction and payment by way of settlement of the judgment in the amount of $314,000, etc., it's reduced. But why are we here?
That's a separate judgment. There was actually a – this case is
– That was a fee award, wasn't it?
It was a separate sanctions judgment based on the conduct of the defendant trying to avoid the judgment in the first place by declaring bankruptcy. So there was a sanctions motion that was brought in the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy awarded sanctions based on his conduct of trying to avoid the judgment. And that bankruptcy judgment was settled. But this judgment...
See, what I'm having trouble with is the total judgment here is what? It's something like $388,000 or so.
$384,000, yes.
$384,000. That looks a lot like a sanction that is essentially in the amount of the underlying judgment. I don't see why. Can you show me that it's tied to attorney's fees or anything? Because I'm not sure whether you're trying to get $700,000 from them, or what's going on?
It was based on separate conduct.
Didn't Judge Cox calculate attorney's fees in the bankruptcy court?
Yes, it was a
This has nothing to do with the district court's original judgment on the sexual harassment case.
Correct.
So this is in addition to the $300,000 in bankruptcy court is in addition to the nearly $400,000 in district court.
Correct.
I need to ask, did Ms. Mendez wind up with any portion of that sanction award from the bankruptcy court?
I believe that she did. I'm not positive. I will actually have to double-check on that.
I assume you all had this on a contingency fee.
We did. And I believe that the majority of that bankruptcy portion goes towards attorney's fees. But I have to double-check on that.
But the question is how that was... since all this was presumably on her behalf on a contingent basis. But let me get to the heart of the question, at least as I see it, which is given the wording of the October 15th minute entry by Judge Duryagian,
yes.
How much more research do you expect the bank to do before it allows its depositors to have access to their account?
The October 15th order by Judge Duryagian didn't have anything to do with the accounts that they released. The accounts that were at Republic...
How did they find out about that order? So they didn't make an appearance in this proceeding by the interveners, did they? Republic Bank.
No. You'd have to ask them. My understanding is I believe that the interveners' counsel informed them of the judgment, or of the order. I apologize.
Okay. Yeah, well, go ahead.
So the October 15th order didn't have anything to do with the accounts that are at issue, which are the judgment debtors' accounts. That motion that was heard on October 15th was brought by certain interveners, and the hearing that was held by Judge Duryagian discussed whether those accounts were...
I understand your point about the hearing and the context and so on, but the bank gets an order that says the only accounts that are to remain frozen pursuant to the citation issued by plaintiff Nereida Mendez against defendants, etc., are as follows, and he did not include the accounts that he should have included, right?
Right. There is a reference to the docket number of the motion in the order. So it says, you know, the accounts not mentioned above, and there's a cross-reference to the motion that was filed, that's docket 312, and those accounts were listed in that motion. Those are the accounts of the interveners.
But, you know, I have the same issue because, of course, third parties, like this bank or any bank, have obligations to their depositors as well as obligations to the court and so on. So when they get an order of the court that's as ambiguous as this one, that's the best I can give you, actually, which is ambiguity. They could be sued by their depositor for failing to honor a proper request to disperse funds in the account. And I don't know why, when something like this comes out, it isn't incumbent on you as the person who's hoping to have clarity about which accounts or which entities are covered by this order and which are not, to file a motion for reconsideration or clarification. I don't know what Judge Duryegin would have done, but I mean, people file such motions.
Well, and first of all,
later on it appears that he thinks he didn't freeze it, but that's so much later on, it doesn't really help you.
Right. The Judge Duryegin reiterated that the accounts should be frozen. He says, I already froze that. Why would I do it again?
Like months later.
Right. But you know, the citation imposes a duty on the bank to hold those funds. It's their duty, and they're to hold those funds.
Until order of the court, though, that's the problem. Is this an order of the court that lifts that obligation from the bank as to this dental PC and dental profile account?
Right. And our argument is that it's unreasonable for the bank to rely on an unrelated order, on an unrelated motion, to say that it unfroze certain accounts. It'd be like me going into the judge and saying, I would like to unfreeze, you know, Judge Wood's accounts. That's not my position or my motion to make. So they're relying unreasonably on, you know, cases or accounts that were never discussed, on a motion that was never filed. So I think if there's some ambiguity, they're the ones that have the duty to freeze the accounts until further order of court. So if they're confused by that,
do you think as a matter of law there actually has to be an order specifically referencing, I mean, the accounts that have been unfrozen? The court does it the other way around. He says, I'm unfreezing everything except these AYLA, AYA dental account, and the two dental profile accounts with nothing in them. And he unfreezes a bunch of other things. AYA Dental, AYA Dental Republic Bank remain frozen. Let me ask you a different question. As you understand it, under the relevant Illinois statute, suppose it is an ambiguous order. It says two parts. It says you can treat it as a contempt, and then it says, or you can make an order for the amount of the judgment.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you see those as two different alternatives? In other words, could an order requiring it to pay the judgment be made without a finding of civil contempt?
Absolutely. The statute, as you pointed out, the plain language of the statute says, or if the party is a third party, the court may enter judgment against him or her in the amount of the unpaid portion of the judgment and costs allowable under the section. That's a completely disjunctive section from the part of the statute that discusses a citation for contempt against a party. I also believe that...
So I guess, let me just jump ahead then. If that's true, we have these two later orders from Judge Lefkoe, and in fact, that's what we're reviewing now. We have her first order, which was in your favor, and then she tries to pull it back because she all of a sudden realizes that Magistrate Judge Valdez has done something, and she does this rather unusual Rule 60B something or other move. If we're looking at Judge Lefkoe's first order, is that something that complies with the standards of the Illinois statute?
Yes, and she found in her first order that plaintiff made her prima facie case and, in fact, pointed out that Republic failed to produce any evidence rebutting the prima facie case. And that was never
That's the order of March 7th.
March 7th. And that finding of a prima facie case was actually never contested in the second order. That still stands, that she found that Republic was served with the citation, it was in furtherance of an enforceable judgment, and Republic permitted the transfer of funds from those accounts.
At the risk of trying to simplify this a little too much, your position is that if the bank negligently fails to comply with the citation order, it can then be held responsible for the funds that were lost. Right?
Yes. There's nothing in the statute that requires willfulness. If you look at Illinois Supreme Court cases, it talks about an act does not cease to be a violation of the law merely because it may have been done innocently. Additionally,
which
I think
are
the
you relying on there?
I'm sorry?
Which one is that?
That is the case that it's County of Cook versus Lloyd A. Fry Roofing Company. Additionally, I believe the Seventh Circuit just a couple weeks ago dealt with an issue of a citation and funds being transferred in West Bend. And in that case, the Seventh Circuit affirmed the underlying judgment where Judge St. Eve had ordered the turnover of funds, but found that there wasn't contempt. So the court discussed that, or affirmed that order, even though there wasn't a finding of contempt, that the party that was transferring funds was that required to turn over those funds.
That was an appeal of the district court decision that's discussed in the bank's briefs.
You know, the Seventh Circuit decision was on March 19th. That was after our briefs.
Okay, yeah.
But that the,
but it's the same case.
The district court case was discussed in the briefs and the orders.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm in my rebuttal time.
Yeah, that's fine. Mr. Freud.
Good morning, Justices. Edward Freud for Republic Bank.
We're actually just judges, but that's all right.
Okay. although, as the district court noted, this case has a long and complicated history. The essential facts concerning the matter before the court here on appeal are uncontroverted.
Well, this case is a mess, you have to concede.
We stepped into a mess, yes.
It seems to me, though, that a lot depends on how, well, on two things. One, whether it actually makes any difference or not, how clear that October 15 order is, if there's no need for contempt. And it's also quite important for us to settle on which of Judge Lefkoe's two orders is the one that's really the one we should be reviewing, because I quaver if I think that Rule 60B is going to be used every time a district court judge takes a look at a memorandum opinion and says, oops, you know, maybe I should have done this a little differently, pull it back from the Court of Appeals and let's go again. I mean, that would be not a good system to run. So that seems to me all that she did. She just had second thoughts. I think either one of her opinions, standing alone, is a sensible opinion. She's a good judge, but which one we look at is very important.
Well, all I can say, and Republic Bank is the willow in the wind on this, we're being asked to rectify issues the court and other parties made, and which are not of our making, and whether Judge Duryagian meant this.
Why not clarify, after that ambiguous October 15 order, before you release the accounts, you could have easily, as a party in interest under the citation, have gone to the court and said, you know, motion for clarification of the accounts of Dental Profile and Dentist's PC covered by your order. You would have saved a lot of time because you would have kept the money and it would have been paid to satisfy the judgment. Republic Bank wouldn't have been out a nickel, not even your attorney's fees here. How much easier?
Actually, we've always taken the position and still do that Judge Duryagian's order was unambiguous.
But I don't find it that way, so perhaps you can indulge
me. But I
want
to go back to, I mean, the Republic Bank did not sit on its rights
It says emergency motion to quash citations, and then this obscure reference to docket number 312 is in there. You know, he has a particular motion in front of him by particular people. District judges are very busy people. He doesn't realize he's governing the world in this one motion. Maybe
Your Honor,
he should have, but he didn't.
Your Honor, what's most important here is the uncontroverted facts. The citation was livened by the clerk of the district court on October 7. On October 11, this is uncontroverted, both all parties agree on this. On October 11, it was sent out by certified mail to Republic Bank. On October 14th, it was received by Republic Bank. And on October 15th at 10 o'clock in the morning, Judge Duryagin heard arguments concerning
Bank
the emergency motion
there.
To quash.
Doesn't, and you didn't join that motion.
We didn't even have notice, I don't believe.
Of course, and so you weren't part of that motion. That's the problem.
Certainly weren't a party.
Right, and so why do you think the motion redounds to your benefit? Usually
no, it didn't redound
to
our benefit or to
yes,
our prejudice.
Yes, it did. You think it relieved
now
the citation.
Now, in hindsight, it prejudiced us, but at the time it was just routine. What's
how,
the essence
how
of
how did the bank get notice of the October
15th? We did get it from Ariel Weisberg, the attorney for the intervener that brought the motion, and who subsequently was the subject of a long hearing on sanctions brought by the plaintiff Mendez, which commenced on March 2nd, 2011, 6 months after the entry of the order of October 15th, in which Mendez claimed Republic Bank was not at all in fault. Weisberg was at fault for not informing the court, Judge Duryagin, of that there were other accounts at Republic Bank. And ultimately,
well, by that time, the entire mess was in full swing, and so I don't blame plaintiffs for, you know, taking whatever positions they can. It's not that they thought it was great that Republic Bank had let these people siphon away every dollar that could have gone to the judgment.
Well, that's an interesting point, and Your Honor first touched on it, and it's true. There were two judgments. I'm not disputing that. But under more unorthodox circumstances, Republic Bank on February 21, 11, turned over $9,800 to the plaintiff, and then the next month in March of 2011, got a turnover order of $56,000.
I understand that.
All
but
I'm
it's
trying
the
to say is that was all applied
Mr.
to
Freud,
the bankruptcy judgment. Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about footnote 2 of your brief.
Yes.
Which is at page 24. It's the one about the $314,000 payment in full satisfaction.
Yes, sir.
What exactly were you trying to suggest we infer from that?
Well, the plaintiff's position is that there is a large unpaid portion of this district court judgment.
And that's true, correct?
I don't know. There was never any affidavit or any proof submitted at any time by the plaintiff as to the unpaid balance. Plus, because I filed an appearance in the district court case and I get the dings on my machine as everything gets filed, I think that could substantially be paid too, but certainly the record reflects that the bankruptcy judgment has been fully paid.
If I could just follow up on that.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I read that footnote, and I had the initial reaction that it seems to me you were probably hoping I would have. What is the plaintiff complaining about here? She's gotten plenty of money. In fact, though, it's an entirely separate judgment, correct?
It is a separate judgment. I've never disputed.
And it's basically irrelevant here, correct?
No, not 100%.
Why not?
Well, the only reason is when we turned over in 2011 almost $70,000, that was all applied to the bankruptcy judgment. So plaintiff says, oh, well, see, you know, our judgment is still substantially unsatisfied.
But it is. They have a judgment for Title VII.
Maybe so.
Damages.
It is.
Well, what are you talking about?
Maybe
look,
so. This footnote, I got to say, looks like an attempt to con us.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't.
Into thinking that the judgment had already been paid.
No, we would have said that much more clearly and much more specifically if this judgment was paid. In fact, Mendez's briefs referred to the bankruptcy proceedings, too, so I'm sorry, and I apologize for any confusion in that regard. It was a footnote.
But it's a payment that has nothing to do with the case
before
us.
All right. Okay. Okay.
Right? If there's one thing that's a bankruptcy sanction having to do with attorney's fees, and then there's a whole different thing of the damages that the person suffered because of unlawful discrimination, what's the link?
As I responded to the question, monies were selectively taken by the plaintiff and applied to one judgment or the other.
That's all I was trying to say.
And other than that, it has no relevance to this case, and it was only a footnote. And if I can assure you that if my position was that the judgment was paid in full, it would have been boldly set forth. Concerning the Rule 60 matter, what I wanted to say was that this was done at Judge Lefkoe's request.
Our point of view as an appellate court, there is a question about which judgment of the district court is the one to which we owe any kind of deference to the extent the district court is making factual statements or otherwise doing things within that district court's authority. Normally, it takes quite a bit to get a Rule 60B ruling, and there has to be something extraordinary. It's not error correction. And so even though she later decides that the magistrate judge was correct on this, her first opinion is a careful opinion as well, offers a different view, and that's why I think the underlying question about how the Illinois law works is critical.
Well, I think Judge Lefkoe's opinion states was that Rule 72 allows a district judge to alter, modify, or reject a report, but
of course
it implies that the court reads it.
I know, and so
else.
Let's just stipulate that she made a mistake by not reading it the first time around. There are countless mistakes made in district court opinions, and the district courts don't go, you know, calling the lawyers in, having somebody come bother the Court of Appeals, pull the case back out of the Court of Appeals. It's a very unseemly set of proceedings for nothing but an ordinary mistake. Mistakes happen.
I think the essence of that issue is what is the Code of Civil Procedure designed to do, and that is to undertake and perform substantial justice.
Of course, and it does so in two ways, and I'll outline the two competing considerations. One is finality, so that everybody finishes up at some point and you just have to take a deep breath and live with it. The other, of course, is that we would like, to the extent possible, for district courts to fix their own mistakes before it comes up here. But that's what Rule 59 is for. This happens outside the time period for Rule 59 correction, and people are entitled to rest on things.
Well, it was, first of all, Republic Bank did what it had a legal right to do. It timely filed its notice of appeal.
And I don't have any problem with that.
And, we took issue. We had always taken issue. We did not deceive anybody. And in fact, the district court called us in. I was personally present at that time. And she said on the record, my face is red because I made a mistake. Now, I understand finality. We all search for finality, especially in what's endless litigation in this Mendez matter.
And did she misuse Rule 60?
No.
When she did that, I don't see any part of Rule 60 that says every time the district judge thinks she's made a mistake, even though the time for a 59 motion is over, she can just pull it back out of the Court of Appeals and fix it.
Rule 60 doesn't say that. But what the district court
The shoe's often on the other foot. You know, people are desperate to try to get Rule 60 changes, and the district judges usually deny them because they say there's just nothing that extraordinary going on here. So why is there a different standard this time?
Well, I can only speak from my experience. I don't have any statistics. After 39 years, a district court not even knowing that the magistrate had issued a report and recommendation was an unusual circumstance. And that's what Judge Lefko found in her discretion. I don't believe she abused.
Why didn't you tell her about it?
Our response, well, the objections were filed by Mendez, and we filed a detailed response to those objections, quoting in our response, in detail, the magistrate Valdez's opinions and findings, okay, so that when the district court said, I didn't even know, I mean, what do I say? To the district court, okay? Yes, we informed the district court the first time around that there was the report and recommendation and cited it extensively in our response and asked the court to affirm it.
Yeah, okay.
All right, I mean, no question that the district court initially made a mistake, and no question.
And she does a de novo review of the evidence. The only thing she doesn't get, really, is another person's view on what it all adds up to. And you're absolutely right. I mean, normally the way things work, the district judge reads that, just as we, on de novo review, certainly read what the district judge or the administrative agency or anybody else did. Not that we're bound by it, but we certainly read it. But she didn't read it, but she does have all the facts in front of her. Just because she failed
to take the opinion the first time, I totally agree. Okay, and I guess what we're here is, did the court abuse her discretion
in using
Rule 60 to set aside, ultimately, a judgment that she knew was manifestly unjust, or believed that? And I want to stress that after we brought the petition for remand, as the district court had requested, and it came back to the district court, we had another full round of briefing. The district court then did not just say, okay, well, now that it's remanded to me, this is what I'm going to do. So we did the whole thing over again. So rather than never having a de novo review...
No, you had two of them, I guess.
They had two of them. That's exactly correct. And say what anyone wants about the district court.
Right.
I personally believe that she did the right thing. She did not abuse her discretion.
Okay. We get that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron.
Anything further, Ms. Carsleeper?
Regarding your question as to the district court's second thoughts, as you pointed out, Rule 60 requires extraordinary circumstances and finding that the underlying order is unjust. In this case, the underlying order, the original order, was correct and not unjust, and Judge Lefko performed her constitutional duties by reviewing the evidence of this case. And so
she made a mistake by failing to, I mean, if everybody was, you had your objections to the magistrate judge's order, they had their responses, she blew it in a sense. She should have read that order.
That order was there for her to read and review, but it wasn't necessary to her decision.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the way the 636 process is supposed to work and the way the magistrate judge system is supposed to work is it's a report and recommendation. The judge isn't supposed to just toss the reports and recommendations in the wastebasket and say, well, actually, I don't really want that. Or can she?
She can. She can. Under the Rule 72, the court can put whatever weight she wants on the magistrate's.
Unknowingly, though?
She has the ability to disregard it if she chooses. What is important under the Constitution is that she provides de novo review of the evidence, which she did in this case. We were none the wiser that she hadn't looked at the magistrate's report because she considered all of the evidence that was before her from both of the parties. So there was really no indication that she hadn't looked at that other than the fact that she disagreed. So in addition, the second opinion that relies on the magistrate judge's opinion, we would submit, is not the opinion that the court should enter in judgment in this case, because she bases it on the erroneous premise that Republic Bank should not be held in contempt because they didn't violate the October 15th order. That's not what this case is about. This case is about whether they violated the citation.
Is it correct that there was just one citation?
There was one citation to Republic Bank.
Okay. And that's the one that's referred to in the October 15th order?
There was more than that citation that was referred to in that October 15th order. There was a citation to MB Financial that also had accounts. MB Financial didn't have a problem understanding the order. And there were also citations to the interveners as well. So there was more than one citation that was at issue on October 15th.
But this citation to Republic Bank, I think I'm holding it at document 497-1, filed 822. Let's see. No, it can't be filed then. But it's a citation to discover assets to Republic Bank of Chicago Legal Department, commanding them to appear at your law offices October 21. It's dated October 7, 2010.
Correct. Yeah, and the purpose of that citation was to seek information relating to the judgment debtor's funds. So when on the October 15th hearing, what's important is that the hearing was all about where are the funds of the judgment debtors. So to say that the court would freeze Aya, because it found that there were funds of the judgment debtors in that account, but not freeze the accounts of the judgment debtors themselves, would be unreasonable. It's an unreasonable interpretation of what occurred. There were questions. My time is up. I was just going to address the issue of what's left of this judgment, unless we've beaten
Please.
That one.
I'd also like very much to know how much money has actually made it into the plaintiff's hands.
What has made it into the plaintiff's hands is the $33,000 that was collected against this judgment. The court order in this case ordered Republic Bank to turn over a judgment of $354,147.30, the difference between the judgment of $387,931 and what had been collected at that time.
Is there post-judgment interest running on this?
I believe there would be.
Presumably, a half a percent or less. And in terms of dollars making it to the plaintiff's hands, I'm talking about as opposed to her counsel.
Right. I believe she has received a portion of the $33,000.
And you all kept the entire $314,000 from the bankruptcy court?
The $314,000 was just attorney's fees based on as a sanction.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? All right. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement. Thanks to all counsel.